Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, we'll speak with the mayor of Memphis, Tennessee, about race relations after Ferguson, Cleveland, and New York.
But first, what's going on with the internet, such as it is, in North Korea? It's been off and on. Who would do that? The first suspect, of course, is the U.S., retribution for that Sony hack. But some internet content delivery companies point out that North Korea might take itself offline to avoid an attack. And how did North Korea become such a threat? The country has only about 1,000 internet addresses. As the New York Times says, that's about as many in one city block in New York. Here and Now, security analyst Jim Walsh is with us from the Security Studies Program at MIT. So, Jim, just start. Your thoughts on North Korea going dark. What are the possibilities?
Well, Robin, you mentioned several of them. I think the most likely attacker is certainly the U.S., given what President Obama said at his press conference. But there have been groups online and in the Twitter sphere taking responsibility for the attack. Some people think it could be South Koreans. Others think it might be the Chinese, sort of yanking on that chain to North Korea to get their attention because they're sort of ticked about all this. And it could be, as you said, North Korea is simply playing defense in advance of a potential attack. But at the end of the day, I would guess the U.S., but that's what makes cyber war different than physical warfare. With a lot of these questions, we just don't know. If you launch an airstrike in Syria, you know that you've launched an airstrike in Syria. There are people killed. There are buildings that get blown up. Not so much in the cyber world.
Yeah. Well, and are you saying that this is cyber war?
Well, I think, that's a great question. I don't know if we have a good definition of that. In the real world, a war is considered 1,000 battlefield deaths. No one's going to die in this particular conflict. But if you have an exchange, if one country goes after another and the other retaliates, that sort of feels like a war to me, or at least a skirmish.
That's so interesting that there is a classic definition. It sounds so calculated, 1,000 deaths.
Yes.
We're talking about deaths, but we take your meaning. But talking about who else might be, what else might be going on here, of course, North Korea's internet service might just be wobbly, but that's probably doubtful. But you mentioned outside people. People are saying that what they are seeing, this idea that it became unstable late on Friday, worsened over the weekend, by Monday was dark, back online, then offline. People are saying that that is consistent with a DDoS attack on routers. Explain.
Yeah, so that's a denial and disruption of service. The idea is to so flood the system, this tiny, fragile system that they have, that it is overwhelms it and the thing is forced to shut down. And so yesterday, I think it was down for 9.5 hours. Now, for a country like North Korea, it really doesn't run on the internet like the U.S. does. Can you imagine what it would be like in the U.S. if we lost 10 hours of internet? I shudder to think what it would be like. Who knows what children would do? But there, I think the impact is less. This is more about, if it is the U.S., this is more about sending a signal.
Yeah. Well, and what might China's involvement be? You said China might be trying to send a message, yank on a chain. Why would China be upset?
Well, a lot of North Korea's cyber assets are actually deployed into China. And so those calls and messages and hacking occur in China. It depends on China for the trunk, for the lines in and out of North Korea. China is not pleased that U.S. Sony was attacked, and they expressed as much in a press conference the other day. They refused to name North Korea as the attacker, but they made it clear that they were unhappy. North Korea is a pain for China. It provides it a buffer. China likes having a land buffer, but it pays a high cost for that because it causes a lot of trouble in the neighborhood that eventually bounces back to China.
And who else might North Korea be working with? We know that the North Korean leaders, some of them have been educated outside of that country. They're not isolated. They might be able to contact people who could do this for them. Is that a speculation?
Sure. I think it's most likely to be homegrown. I remember visiting North Korea and visiting a school, this giant school, and walking into a room and dozens, 100-plus deaths of little children working at little computers. Again, this is all in an intranet. They didn't have access to the broader world, but this was a closed system within North Korea. So they've been training people for a long time. It could be them. They could also proxy that out. They could hire Chinese hackers to do it. They could hire others to do it. Yeah. But my guess is that it's homegrown.
And what's the talk in the security world that this has happened at all?
Well, I think it's not a surprise that there is a cyber attack, and North Korea has been involved in that before. I had my laptop attacked, but I think what is a surprise is the nature of the attack, the public response, Sony's response, and this sort of first ever tying together of both a cyber attack and then a threat of terrorism. The whole movie theater's piece of this, which remains to me to be a curious thing, and that doesn't really add up. But combining a threat of terrorism, actual physical terrorism, with cyber attack, that was the difference in this case.
And something people like you are analyzing. Jim Walsh, here and now security analyst. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Well, in New York today, Mayor Bill de Blasio is holding a moment of silence at 2:47 p.m. Eastern Time to mark the moment those two NYPD officers were shot on Saturday. De Blasio has been trying to ease tensions with the police, who are angry at him for sympathizing with protesters upset by police tactics. Joining us now with a unique perspective on this is the mayor of one of the most African-American cities in the United States, Mayor A.C. Wharton of Memphis, Tennessee. Mayor, it's great to have you back.
Jeremy, thanks for having me back.
And I want to start by getting your thoughts on what we're seeing right now in New York City. We've just had the weekend shootings of two police officers in Brooklyn, and a lot of anger at Mayor de Blasio. The union head of the police union, Patrick Lynch, said the killings are in part the mayor's fault, that he's got blood on his hands for not standing up for the police. Let's listen.
That blood on the hands starts on the steps of City Hall in the office of the mayor.
Mayor Wharton, you're a mayor. You're also African-American. What do you make of that?
Well, as mayor of a large urban city in which the same kindling that gave rise to the fires in New York and other cities are right here in Memphis, and so we're always reluctant to weigh in and make any comment on what's happening in another city. We're all walking precariously, trying to just toe that tightrope between saying that this is America and everybody has the right to demonstrate and speak out, of which they do. But on the other hand, what is incendiary? What is too much? What are the limits? We're all so afraid. I talk to mayors all over the country, and we're all just wondering, you know, could it happen here? And we all know, quite frankly, yes, it could happen here. I guess all I can say, Jeremy, is that all life is precious. I am at a loss for words.
Well, have you ever faced a situation where you've had to struggle between standing up with the police and showing support for the police and at the same time reflecting the anger of community against something that the police had done?
Oh, yes. Two or three years ago, we had a situation in which a police officer, I believe, was off duty, was somehow engaged with a teenage black boy, and said the young man tried to rob him, and of course he was shot and killed by the officer. Then we had a horrible auto accident in which the police officer was in a pursuit that had been called off, and I think his car was clocked at just before the accident, 93 miles per hour, I believe it was. Ended in the loss of life of at least three people. The public was demanding answers. I'm calling the family, saying as best I could that we regretted what had happened. But the police basically were saying, look, don't rush to judgment on this. Who are you siding with? So yeah, it's a tightrope that every mayor of any big city could potentially have to walk. And I suppose this is why you want mayors who are reflective, who learn that words sometimes can be just as lethal as bullets. It's just amazing that we don't have more confrontations like this.
Well, let's reflect on some of what we've seen this year. And we've heard people right up to President Obama talk about race relations in this country. Let's listen to him earlier this month, right after a grand jury declined to indict the police officer who put a chokehold on Eric Garner.
This is an issue that we've been dealing with for too long, and it's time for us to make more progress than we've made. And I'm not interested in talk. I'm interested in action. And I am absolutely committed as President of the United States to making sure that we have a country in which everybody believes in the core principle that we are equal under the law.
Mayor Wharton, how has Memphis responded to and taken in all of these various incidents? It's a city that is 64% African-American.
I think the best way to deal with a situation like Staten Island or like Cleveland or like Ferguson is to do your doggonedest to prevent it. What, in other words, do some of the things that we're doing here. Our police director has what he calls a clergy academy that meets regularly. I have a faith-based council, and we call them in, and when we see trouble in their communities, we tell them we're going to have to do something. So they know that it's going to be more interactions between young black boys on the corner and police officers. So if you make sure that there's something organic in the neighborhoods that can perhaps serve as a sprinkler system, much as is the case in a building where a fire breaks out and the sprinkler system goes off before the fire engine gets there. Many times when the fire engine gets there, it's too late. Mayors in these instances are fire engines, and half the building is gone by the time we show up. But if we, in our neighborhoods, create the social infrastructure, that's the best way to deal with it, is to prevent it, go all out. We call it community policing. Here's one of the things we discussed with Attorney General Holder when he was here. Now, does that mean it will not happen in Memphis? Absolutely not. But I would say never, never, never give up trying to prevent it.
We're speaking with Mayor A.C. Wharton of Memphis, Tennessee. You're listening to Here and Now.
Our big story at 4:30, it's the most wonderful time of the year. No, we're not talking about Christmas, but we're talking about those low gas prices.
And that is wonderful. The Mid-South is seeing some of the lowest in the country, and that's helping.
That is the top of the newscast at WREG in Memphis, Tennessee, a city that has had a difficult time making a comeback from the recession. We've been speaking with the mayor of Memphis, A.C. Wharton. And Mayor, this is a year in which we've seen a lot of good economic news in this country, even if things are still difficult for many people. How are things going in Memphis?
They're not as rosy as they are in some of the cities out west, Texas and North Dakota and all, where they've discovered fracking and all. But things are stabilizing. By that, I mean our unemployment is no longer increasing. It's still a double digit in far too many neighborhoods, particularly the brown and black neighborhoods. But at least we believe it's bottomed out. So there is a sense of optimism.
It's about 6.8%, it looks like, overall in the city in November, compared to about 5.8% nationally.
That's correct. So you see, this is why we're not celebrating here yet. We've got a 27% poverty rate. So when you see 6.8, that's particularly troublesome in a poverty-ridden community, riddled community that we have here in Memphis. Other more robust economies could absorb that without any difficulty. But that's not so in Memphis. So it has bottomed out. We haven't declared a day of celebration yet. We're coming up with more jobs training programs. So I would say the outlook is much better than it has been for the past 3 or 4 years.
Have you gotten what you needed from Washington?
Oh, well, you know, at a time when we need the community development block grant funds, they have been cut. But we were fortunate here in Memphis because we got other resources from Washington. We were one of the Strong Cities, Strong Communities program. So we have actual staff people from Washington on the ground here who have been of immense benefit. And if you look at cities that are holding on and growing, you show me a mayor who sits around his or her hometown hoping that the legislative body will give them the money they need, that city is not going anywhere. But if you look at cities like Philadelphia, New Orleans, Atlanta, and I'll throw Memphis in, we spend probably just as much time in New York as we do in our own state houses. Mayor Bloomberg has been really great. So we've had to be a bit more enterprising and just quit waiting on the federal government because, quite frankly, it has not been there. Our funding for housing and community development is stagnant at best and being reduced in many instances. The delays on the transportation bill have caused so much of a backlog here in Tennessee. So we've got to find other ways of doing it. Other ways mean don't wait on the feds. Go to your state legislature, get them to increase the fuel tax, and that's what we're doing. But to answer your question, no, we've not gotten what we needed from Washington, D.C.
Well, and as you say, you're a Democratic mayor who's having to deal with a state house that is Republican. You're in a very Republican state there in Tennessee. Just finally, as we now prepare for the changeover from a Democratic Senate in Washington to a Republican Senate in Washington, President Obama is going to have to deal with an opposition party in both houses of Congress. What would your advice be to him about trying to work with the other party?
Try to find out precisely what it is the people back home are asking for. And when you call them over to Capitol Hill, don't talk in terms of the Democratic way of doing this or the Republican way of doing this or the Tea Party way of doing this. Just simply bring it on down to the lowest common denominator and say, look, this is what the folks back in your state, back in your district are asking for. This is not coming from the White House. This is coming from the people back home. I hope that we can tone down the sharp partisan edge and kind of govern the way mayors do. And when I go to the city council, I don't go in, and I'm sure you've heard this said before, and say, I've got the best Republican kind of garbage plan you can find anywhere, or I've got the best Democratic way to run these parks. When I walk in, I go in and say, I was in Orange Mound last week. They need this. I was in Whitehaven 2 weeks ago. This is what they told me they wanted. Kind of folksy. But he's got to run the White House the way a mayor would run and just stay as close to the people as he can, project not from the standpoint of I'm this party or that party or you have a majority and I'm in the minority or whatever. The people back home could care less about who's in the majority or minority. When you do not get the funds you need to clean up blight or to keep a medical clinic open, I've never heard someone go back home saying that they needed surgery, but they couldn't get it down at the clinic there because there was a Republican in Washington. Hmm. It just doesn't resonate. That's not what happens in the streets of America. So I would go back to the Ronald Reagan days of reading a letter from somebody who wants this or who supports that. And just keep running it that way. You may remember John Sununu, who had a saying that it's only the people in the streets who read the words to the song. The people in the street just listen to the beat.
Hmm.
Get with the beat. You remember on American Bandstand, every Wednesday they would play three songs, and invariably, the teenagers would tell Dick Clark, you know, the words are good, but you can't dance to it. My advice would be to the folks in Washington, forget about the words to the song. Forget about the lyrics. The people in the streets don't dance to the lyrics. They dance to the beat. Pick up what the beat is, what the heartbeat, what the beat in the streets is, and I think he'll be well served and our nation will be well served.
Mayor A.C. Wharton of Memphis, Tennessee, with some words of wisdom there. Mayor Wharton, thanks so much and happy holidays to you.
Jeremy, thanks for allowing me to visit with you. Happy holidays to you.
And I have to say, quite a difference in Memphis in the last few years, as there has been all over the country. I first met the mayor back in 2010 on a reporting trip when that city was reeling from the housing collapse. Wall Street banks had been accused of what they called reverse redlining, going after minority homeowners and getting them to refinance into mortgages that were very risky, they couldn't afford, and went bust. A lot of people lost their homes. I remember driving through neighborhoods in Memphis that were abandoned. Well, as the mayor just said, the unemployment rate overall in Memphis now just 6.8%, still about a point higher than the national average, but some good economic news all around the country. Certainly welcome there in Memphis.
And cord cutters, people who have untethered themselves from traditional cable to watch TV and video in other ways, are getting a gift from the FCC, which is proposing a very technical rule change that would remove some key barriers to online TV and video streaming. It will also benefit companies like Dish Network, as well as giants like Sony and Verizon, which want to offer pay TV over the Internet. Amy Schatz is senior editor for policy at the tech news site Recode. She joins us from Washington. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And this past October, FCC Chair Tom Wheeler said that 21st century consumers should not be shackled to rules that only recognize 20th century technology. So first explain what he meant. What are the rules now and what's the FCC proposing?
All right, so the FCC is basically talking about removing some technical barriers to make it easier for these online companies to offer cable-like services that would compete with the more traditional cable or satellite TV service that we all subscribe to today, with the goal of just increasing competition in the pay TV market, because there's not much competition right now.
And what are we talking about further? Again, for people who haven't followed this, are these online services that are doing their own content, or do they want to use content from the traditional companies?
The idea is, and most of these services have not yet launched, they're working on it right now, they're trying to put together bundles of channels that they could then offer to consumers to stream over the Internet to their TVs that could be possibly smaller and cheaper than what you could get right now from a Comcast or a DirecTV.
So it could be HBO that an Internet company wants to offer.
Right. It could be HBO. It could be the local local broadcast channels, it could be ESPN. You know, we don't really have any details yet because right. A lot of these companies are still trying to put these packages together, but they're having some problems doing it.
Well, and so speaking of which, people might be thinking of Aereo. This is the company that was offering streaming on the Internet, but it was for free, and they made the claim that they were taking it from the airwaves. They were just pulling it down in a technical way, but the Supreme Court ruled against them, saying that, you know, Aereo was violating copyright laws by just taking this programming out of the out of the air and then delivering it. So that company lost and went out of business. Would these rule changes affect a company like Aereo that just wants to take product for free?
You know, they could help an Aereo if Aereo wanted to actually pay for the channels. The problem Aereo ran into is that they were trying to get something for nothing
right. And
then sell it. If they were to, you know, actually pay the broadcast channels to rebroadcast their service over the Internet, then, you know, these rules, what the FCC is proposing to do now would help allow that to happen.
Right. And so what does it say? What does this potential rules change say about whether or not those companies that have that content have to work with these new startups that want to take that content?
You know, in some instances, they actually wouldn't have to work with these online companies. If you're a Disney or if you're a Viacom, you don't have to offer Comedy Central to Sony or to Dish Network. But for the most part, they would generally want to because it means more revenue for them. And for consumers, this just might mean more competition and more choices in the future, because there are a lot of cord cutters out there who aren't happy with how much they have to pay right now.
And yet there were two commissioners on the FCC who are opposed to this. They are Republican. What's their argument?
They don't like the idea of the FCC moving into more regulation over Internet companies. They just are generally anti-regulation, and so it was more on about that.
On that level. But these Internet companies would applaud this regulation because it would help them. Interesting. What does this mean briefly for Apple TV?
You know, for Apple, I mean, Apple's already sort of moving, we assume, with some kind of new TV service, you know, not necessarily what they have right now, which they're selling to consumers. But, you know, this helps multiple companies who are trying to, you know, come up with new packages to compete with Comcast or Direct.
Yep. That's Amy Schatz, senior editor for policy at the tech news site Recode. The FCC taking comments now on its considered rules change. So you might want to weigh in. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Hanukkah. Tonight is the last night of Hanukkah. And for the last week, the soundtrack at many parties has included klezmer, the traditional music of East European Jews. Klezmer music was fading out in America after World War II, but there was a revival in the late 1970s by young Jews who'd been playing in the bluegrass and old-time music scene. Then, for 30 years, klezmer musicians gathered in New York at a Catskills hotel during Christmas week for an event known as Kletz Camp. Alas, this year's Kletz Camp will be the last. Producer John Kalish takes a look back.
In 1985, NPR asked me to cover the very first Kletz Camp. I didn't know what klezmer music was back then. When I got to the Borscht Belt Hotel where the klezmer tribes had gathered, I met a banjo player named Henry Sapoznik, who explained that klezmer music was part of a larger Yiddish culture.
It really gives people a sense that not only is it really hot music, but that it's ours. Not only is this something I can dance to, but I could feel that this is something that my great-grandparents danced to.
For many participants, the high point of Kletz Camp was the nightly jam sessions. In the early years, the jam involved a mix of klezmer's new wave, mostly people in their 30s, and old-timers who had been playing klezmer music before the revival began. Most of those old-timers are no longer around, including the late clarinet player Sid Beckerman.
Sid would put the clarinet to his lips. 90 minutes later, he would take it out. He was just playing for 90 minutes. It was like the longest set of D minor in the history of music.
The klezmer revival not only provided opportunities for the klezmer veterans to play gigs, but to teach the music to a new generation. Here's Sid Beckerman when I spoke to him in 1985.
It's a pleasure for me just to be with them and just to teach them whatever I can in a short period of time. They're into it, they do a lot of practicing, and it shows in their playing.
In the 30 years since Kletz Camp started, a diverse Yiddish arts scene has flourished in the United States. But back in the mid-1980s, Yiddish was not exactly hip in the Jewish community here. Kletz Camp founder Henry Sapoznik.
Yiddish was considered a bad joke. It was a punchline. It seemed totally antithetical. People looked at you like, you want to revive Yiddish? You may as well revive the sacrifices at the temple.
But the klezmer revival kept chugging along, and the initial turnout of 90 people for the first Kletz Camp grew to more than 600 at Kletz Camp's peak in the early 2000s. Klezmer bands had formed in almost every major city and in a lot of small towns as well, taking the music in new directions. The Klezmatics made klezmer rock. David Krakauer jazzified his klez. And Margot Leverett and her klezmer mountain boys started mixing klezmer with bluegrass.
All the trends that you see in the contemporary klezmer movement either were reflected at Kletz Camp or were started at Kletz Camp.
Trumpet player Frank London co-founded the Grammy Award-winning Klezmatics. He likens Kletz Camp to a shtetl. Shtetls were the small, tight-knit towns inhabited by Jews in Europe before the Holocaust.
Kletz Camp served the role of being kind of the community, the shtetl that we didn't live in, because it was kind of a global shtetl. Everything was separated by distance, and here was a place that we all got together.
Kletz Camp was intentionally held during Christmas week, and for many Jews, missing out on the Christmas frenzy was part of the charm of Kletz Camp.
It was sort of like the Yiddish musical equivalent of The Shining. You know, we were trapped in this snowbound place. We were insulated. It was as if the whole world, instead of watching the Yule log or listening to Bing Crosby singing White Christmas, for that one little bit of time, you know, it was a Yiddish world. We had reclaimed a real place for ourselves, not as a minority, but, you know, we felt like this was the sound of the season.
I have lots of little kids. They are running naked. But I have more deaths than hand. I cannot take it. When they come home from the shop, oh, am I so tired? Kids are singing children's songs, then they start a riot. Oh, am I a mighty lucky Jew?
The Brothers Nazarov is made up of klezmer musicians living on three continents. Brooklyn-based Jake Shulman-Ment is the group's fiddler and a veteran of Klez Camp.
I went every year pretty much all through high school with my family. I really grew up musically there. Klez Camp really changed my life.
Shulman-Ment is now considered one of the finest klezmer fiddlers on the planet, but when he was a teenager, he was just another kid in the Klez Kids program at Klez Camp. It drew as many as 50 or 60 kids some years. Sarah Gordon has run Klez Kids in recent years. Gordon has been attending Klez Camp since she was 6 years old. She's the daughter of the late Yiddish vocalist Adrian Cooper, and she sings in a rock band called Yiddish Princess. Gordon says this last Klez Camp gathering will be bittersweet.
It does feel like a huge loss for me and my friends. Kind of like that thing where you expect to go back to your same house forever on Thanksgiving and then your parents sell the house. You're like, what are we going to do now? And I think that that's what it feels like.
Klez Camp founder Henry Sapoznik says he's preparing to make a vast archive of classes and performances recorded at Klez Camp available online. Klez Canada, an event that takes place in Quebec in the summer, is expected to carry on the Klez Camp tradition in North America. And veterans of Klez Camp are already planning a klezmer gathering next Christmas here in New York City. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says one of his biggest challenges as he prepares to take control of the Senate is to convince his fellow Republicans that passing bills is not a bad thing. He made those comments in an interview published today in the New York Times, which points out that McConnell was a big reason very little got passed while he was leading the opposition party. He offers this piece of advice to the Times: all of us from time to time make a point, but it is time now to make a difference. Well, that's one piece of political advice. We heard another when we traveled to Raleigh, North Carolina, ahead of November's midterm election. It had to do with barbecue. We sat down at dinner with a politician whose political career ended because of it, and with a TV host and author.
I'm Bob Garner, and I've written 4 books, and my latest one is called Foods That Make You Say, mm-mm. Because that's sort of a tagline of mine on TV.
So when you look at the nation of barbecue, you think of Memphis and the dry rub there. You think of Kansas City. You think of Texas barbecue. Right. And you think of North Carolina barbecue. But what you're saying is there's not one North Carolina barbecue, and that's very important.
Yeah, there are actually 2 styles plus all the other American regional styles. Here in eastern North Carolina, the English and the Scots-Irish settlers did what they saw the Native Americans already doing when they showed up. The Spanish had been into the Southeast 100 years before, had introduced pigs. A lot of those pigs had gone back to the wild. So the settlers came in and found the Native Americans already barbecuing what were then feral or wild pigs over pits dug into the ground, frameworks of green sticks that they constructed to put the meat on, and they would smoke or pit cook that meat over those beds of coals. And that became the style that the English and the Scots-Irish settlers in this part of the state copied. Much later on, the German migration began to move down from Pennsylvania through Virginia and into North Carolina, and they had a fondness for the pork shoulder, they had been used to consuming that. They liked to braise it in kind of a apple-flavored liquid. They liked a little bit sweeter and a little bit milder sauce. In eastern North Carolina, it's very peppery, a vinegary type sauce that was originally developed in eastern North Carolina.
Well, that is the kind of barbecue that I would think of is North Carolina barbecue, that vinegary sauce.
Right, and that sauce used to be common all over the original 13 colonies, but now that particular flavoring only survives in eastern North Carolina, and that's because people didn't used to eat tomatoes. In colonial days, they thought they were poisonous. They were grown mainly as ornamental plants. By the time barbecue became popular, they had learned that tomatoes were safe to eat. So they started adding a little tomato and a little sugar, making a little sweeter, milder sauce that sort of imitated that German sauce, type sauce that they had brought a taste for.
Does barbecue have anything to do with politics?
You know, people would argue that barbecue has almost everything to do with politics. First of all, political gatherings just featured barbecue very often because it was a cheap way to feed a crowd. These political caravans would come to town with people running for office from state offices down to the most local offices, and they would have a big political caravan, a big gathering, maybe at the courthouse or in the town square. They would have free barbecue. It was a way to kind of get people to stay around, listen to speeches, and you could feed a crowd of people very inexpensively. And we had a former Secretary of State who used to joke years ago that when these political caravans came to town, all the pigs would run and hide because they knew that there were going to be a lot of pigs giving their life in the service of politics. So it's always been the food of politics in North Carolina, more for practical reasons than any other. You could, even back in the covered wagon days, people could chop up a lot of barbecue and feed a lot of people rather inexpensively.
Well, this is a perfect moment for me to bring in our other guest here who knows very well what barbecue means for politics in North Carolina. And Rufus, if you could just introduce yourself.
My name is Rufus Edmiston. I'm a recovering politician, and I was elected Attorney General in 1974, ran for governor in 1984, lost, I'll tell you why in a minute, and I am now, as one of my little nephews one time said, Uncle Rufus is a lobster, a lobbyist.
A lobbyist now, but let's go back to that reason that you lost. What happened?
Oh, well, now there are many, many versions of that antic, but I can tell you exactly what happened. This is from the hog's mouth. I'd been campaigning day and night in a very strenuous campaign that year. There were 10 of us running, as Bob remembers. 10 people said it was Pharaoh's army, and I'd knock one down, and then here'd come another one over the hill. It was like a cavalry. And one night, I was at the NC Faculty Club, Bob, and after it was over, for some reason, so I said, you been getting enough barbecue to eat lately? Well, something came over me that no one in their right mind would ever do. I said, yes, I certainly have. I'm tired of it. Hope I never see another drop as long as I live.
You said that?
I said that. And I was joking, of course. Well, the next morning, News and Observer has an article, Edmiston Attacks Barbecue. And then to top it all off, though, as the day wore on, this thing gained a lot of steam. And my friend Wilbur Shirley, who Bob knows very well, called me. He was my campaign manager for Eastern North Carolina. He said, what in God's name did you say about barbecue? My phone is ringing off the hook. I said, Wilbur, I was just kidding. And I'd like to never got him back. And so I decided to call a press conference because it was gaining momentum. And I hadn't made the mistake of saying you like Eastern or Western. That's another thing Bob will tell you, that you don't dare say I choose Eastern over Western. And I called a press conference and I said, it is very obvious to me that the devil made me say that. There's just no way in my right mind I would ever have said that. But the devil made me say it, and I have an appointment with an exorcist. And I'm headed that way, and I'm sure that by tomorrow morning I will have removed all the iniquity in that statement I made about barbecue, and it has continued to this day. I've judged many a barbecue contest since that time. I judged two the past week.
Because of that?
Obviously, why else are they going to call me? You know, they don't usually call on recovering politicians to do anything.
Do you really think you lost because of that?
Well, you add that up with Ronald Reagan coming through here twice and taking the state by 63%, and then that's it, yeah. And a few other little things like singing too much Honky Tonk Angel when my mother said, "My boy Rufus, he's a good boy. If he'd have sung a lot more Amazing Grace and a lot less Honky Tonk Angel, he might have been governor." So you add up singing too much Honky Tonk Angel, add the barbecue faux pas to that, and you have a disaster for a defeat.
So when you go to these contests now and judge them, do you like barbecue now, or what, was that really a one-off?
I never stopped liking the barbecue. That's the whole thing about this deal. I never stopped liking it. I have withdrawals at times. I sometimes have to go off for 4 or 5 days on these fancy trips now that I make for clients, and I get these distinct barbecue hunger pains. You can get too much of anything, but you can also make a fool of yourself like I did. But it's been a lot of fun for me.
It was a lot of fun for us to eat the barbecue and the banana cream pie. And afterwards, I had one more observation. Well, here we are. The plates are pretty empty at this point. We've done a very good job eating. It's delicious barbecue. And I will say, Rufus, you did eat it. You clearly like what you had.
Yes. It's taken 30 years to do it, but I think it's about time I've proven myself, and I do it.
Rufus Edmiston, former Attorney General of North Carolina, talking to us back in October. We also heard from author and TV host Bob Garner. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.